This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Lots of Americans agree that our public school system isn't working, but there's no national program for reform in place. That's in part because there's little agreement on which reforms would be best, and there's no money to implement the reforms anyways. In the meantime, there are a variety of independent programs testing out new models in public education. One of the most highly regarded systems is held together by the Coalition of Essential Schools, a partnership between Brown University and participating high schools. My guest, Theodore Sizer, chairs the coalition and is a professor at Brown. He's the former dean of the Harvard Graduate School of Education and former headmaster at Phillips Academy. His new book is Horace's School, Redesigning the American High School. Sizer's approach to redesigning high schools responds to some of the frustrations he faced back when he taught in a public school. One of his greatest frustrations was having too many students.
In my second year of teaching, I had 204 kids, and I only got to know in any significant way a fraction of them. And at the end of the year, it was very disarming to realize that I probably had touched the minority in any consequential way. A later frustration was to realize slowly the confusion that the traditional way of presenting a high school curriculum causes in kids. They go from math to physics to history to phys ed. In good schools, each of these planned coherently within the subject, but in no schools planned coherently across subjects. So it was a serious conversation, more or less serious conversation, each for 52 minutes, with the subject changed drastically and the bell rang. It's a recipe for confusion.
Can you give us a sense of what a day in school might be like in one of the schools that you've redesigned?
Well, if we were to visit a typical school in our coalition that's really moved ahead, we would first of all notice there are no bells to ring, or any bells ringing. We would find the school noisier, but the noise would be student voices discussing among themselves and explaining things to teachers rather than teachers' voices lecturing to the kids. If we looked at a daily schedule, we'd find maybe two or three large blocks of time, and how that time being spent decided by the particular team of teachers and the youngsters working together, which is to say the high school would look structurally a lot more like an existing good elementary school than like the traditional high school. We would find students, if we listened carefully to the substance of what was being said, we'd find students endlessly asked to explain why they'd come to the conclusions they had come to. We'd find the outline of the curriculum to be very short, maybe no more than three broadly defined topics or subjects, such as the arts, history and philosophy, and math and science.
Well, let me stop you here. Uh-huh. One of your frustrations as a teacher was that you had too many students and you couldn't really get to know all of them well, let alone reach them in a meaningful way. So in your redesigned high school, how many students would a teacher have?
Well, in our coalition, the target is no more than 80. In many schools, particularly schools in big cities, the contract ratio is 175 youngsters to one teacher. That is five classes a day of 35 students.
So if you have 80 students, does that mean you have two classes or a lot of classes with a small number of students?
Well, I think that the best way to describe that, first of all, is to precede it with the assertion that the schools in our that are working with us undertake to change these loads for teachers without changing the budget. That is, we don't bring down the student loads by tripling the faculty. Not that that wouldn't be nice, but it's not going to happen. There isn't the money in the system to do it. So if we're not going to significantly change the budget, steps such as the following would have to take place. I'm a social studies teacher, and you are an English teacher, and each of us has 160 youngsters a day coming at us in five different classes. We go to the principal and we say to the principal, give us the same 160 kids. And I will take 80 and you will take 80. and I will teach both English and social studies to these youngsters, and you will teach English and social studies to your 80 youngsters, and I will observe you and set standards for you in social studies with which you're not as familiar as you should be, and you will likewise keep a control on the quality of my English teaching. Now, the compromise I make and you make is we have to teach more broadly English and social studies, and we have to suffer the indignity of a colleague keeping track of us and holding us to a standard. But what we've gained is half as many students, that is 80 rather than 160, and we see those youngsters twice as long each day as then we used to.
Yeah, but let me just point out here, what you've done for me is you've given me half the number of students, which I appreciate, but you've doubled the number of classes I have to prepare and double the amount of subject matter that I need to get a handle on. And this includes subject matter that I have no claims to really have any deep comprehension of.
Yes, there's no free lunch. But the evidence is that once you get up to speed and really knock the rust off that English minor or that social studies minor that you had in college, the full effect of the change will be brought to bear. And furthermore, what I've just described to you is a long-time practice in originally junior high schools and now middle schools. English and social studies have been merged in a multidisciplinary situation, as often has mathematics and science. Again, the example I've given you is this kind of crude one. In fact, schools that are moving in this direction have to do about three or four other things at once. That is, the teams have to be richer than just two teachers. They may be four or five, and the groups of students somewhat larger, 100, 120. But as I show in the appendix to my new book, you can take a typical school and on a piece of paper rearrange this and show it how it can be done. It's quite easy to do on a piece of paper. The tough part is doing it in the real world where each of us wants to teach only the narrow subject we've been trained in, and we're quite happy to work in isolation. That is not subject to the review and criticism of our peers.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Theodore Sizer, and he is a professor at Brown University, where he chairs the Coalition of Essential Schools, and this is a coalition that has redesigned several high schools. His new book is called Horace, a School Redesigning the American High School. Do you think that the system as it is now encourages mediocrity in teaching? And what I mean by that is, teaching is certainly not a prestige job in our society at the moment, certainly not teaching high school. Salaries are, I mean, they're certainly livable, but they're not, you're not handsomely rewarded for teaching. And it's an incredibly difficult job, not only because of all the students and of the problems that students can give you, but I mean, if you're a good teacher, you have to go home every night and prepare lessons and grade papers and really wrestle in your mind about what you're going to do the next day in class and what grade you're going to give a student, because a lot of this really is very subjective. And if you care, you're going to be awfully busy.
Mm. Well, there are really two ways of viewing your question. As you phrased it at the beginning, it is the way we run school, the way we pursue schooling, force mediocrity? And my answer to that is yes, in a number of ways. That there is this notion that more is better. And the more facts, the more things one can cover, that means the stronger and tougher the curriculum. In fact, by, for instance, having a world history course for 14 and 15-year-olds, where you go from Cleopatra to George Bush in 6 months, trivializes, really mocks serious history and distorts, and thus is mediocre. At the same time, many of the tests which are imposed on the schools, tests that usually for reasons of tight budgets, are quite flimsy. again, trivialize. They reduce serious questions, questions demanding really thoughtful answers. It reduces them to a kind of dartboard of choosing this option over some other option. The multiple choice, as the kids say, multiple guess kind of education. And the extent to which our teachers and kids and schools are judged on the basis of scores on those pseudo-tests is the extent to which teachers teach to them, thus once again trivializing education. At the same time, you talked about the mediocre incentives that the society gives to strong people to get into teaching and to stay in teaching, whether those be weak salaries or a kind of demeaning attitude which where we say they're professionals, but we insist they punch time clocks, and where they, in fact, are driven along by rules much as the students are, where the number of minutes actually, God save us, spent in teaching some subject in a classroom is set by some bureaucrat at the state level rather than by a teacher who happens to know the kids. In my experience, very able people are very ready to leave teaching. Not that the salaries are so bad initially, but because the way that the system treats them is so demeaning. It incents, it assumes they're mediocre, and in many cases sets up a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Have you taken a different approach to working with inner-city schools than with suburban schools?
No. I think the basic ideas that drive good schooling apply at a general level, to all kids. What has been striking in our work over the last 8 years is most of the most ambitious schools, the most risk-taking schools, the ones where the progress has been the most pronounced, are schools serving low-income families. And in many ways, what conventional wisdom would say were the most difficult communities, in fact, have moved ahead most ambitiously. And I think the reason for this is those communities, those families in those places, know that the risks of not changing are greater than the risks of trying something new. Where on the other hand, the majority schools, affluent schools, where the system seems to serve their kids well, that is, they get into their colleges of their choice, which is different than saying they've been given a rigorous education, don't want any change, or they want very little change because they say, in a quite justified way, from their point of view, the system's working for my kids.
My guest is educator and author Ted Sizer. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Theodore Sizer, and he's the author of the new book, Horace, A School Redesigning the American High School. He is the head of the Coalition of Essential Schools at Brown University, which is a coalition that has redesigned several high schools in the area and around the country. There are schools in your area and around the country who have adopted your coalition's approach to curriculum. I was reading an article about the coalition from about a year ago that said that you had struck a bargain with the governors in six states that the governors would, that you would launch 10 schools in each state if the governors would put up funding, waive restrictive regulations, and then run political interference. Give us your interpretation of this. How does it work in a state when you and the state agree to try out your curriculum in several schools?
Well, for example, in Delaware, the Governor Castle and leaders in the legislature and some leaders in the university and some leaders in the business community agreed to a process which was endorsed by the State Board of Education to give running room in one way or another to those schools which elected on their part to step forward and join the coalition. And furthermore, the state and Kraft General Foods, the lead business in this, provided planning money and training money to those schools that wanted to proceed. And what has evolved in Delaware is a number of schools that have taken advantage both of the running room, that is, waived regulations, and the resources to to visit other schools, to do the work, to run their own staff development programs, so that these schools are developing plans now, which in a few years, if you and I visited, we'd find them quite different than they are today. Also in Delaware, with state funds, there have been a couple of veteran educators who have been given full time to work among these schools to bring together like-minded mathematics teachers, for example, and to stimulate the most ambitious plans and to back the most imaginative people. Delaware is not the only state that's taken this kind of supportive and an enabling role. We see it in Arkansas, we see it in New Mexico, in Illinois, in Pennsylvania, and it's a hopeful sign.
You know, I've been both a student, of course, and a teacher very briefly, and as a teacher I felt, oh, geez, this system is really flawed, I can't function in it, I'd better leave. As a student, I found that the teachers who really meant something to me, who I really walked away feeling transformed by, weren't teachers who had like a pedagogical theory of teaching. They were teachers who were kind of passionately committed to the subject matter, knew a lot about it, and made it so interesting because of their interest, knowledge, and passion that it was almost contagious. And they were interesting speakers, too. They really knew how to put it across. They could tell a good story. They could bring the subject matter to life. It wasn't a boring recitation. It was a really interesting story that you wanted to be in on. I guess I mention this because whenever I hear about a new system for redesigning the schools or a new pedagogical theory, sometimes it just always boils down to me to, well, how good is the teacher going to be? How good a speaker are they going to be? How much are they going to care about their material?
Teaching has been led down a primrose path by people who think it's a science. That is, that teaching is, if we just got the grammar of teaching right, if everybody did their nouns in the same way, if you followed the seven steps, then everything would be just dandy. That's nonsense. Any more than one studies nothing but grammar, grammar, grammar in order to write like John Updike. I mean, good teaching, whether it is telling or provoking or coaching, is an expression of personality. Each one of us, as individuals, puts our particular spin on it, and that's a wonderful thing. And we must look at teaching as both science and art. Sure, there is a lot we can learn about learning. There's a lot that we can sense in how kids are reacting to things, which are observable in patterns. People before us can tell us something about how kids react in general. Not a particular kid, that is always idiosyncratic, but kids in general. But beyond that, it's really our craft, our artistry, our thoughtful application of the best we know through the vehicle of our own personalities. And I think if you and I reflect back on teachers who had really inspired us, we would find them quite different. They inspired us in different ways.
Absolutely.
And that's really, that is an expression of the important individualism and artistry of the craft, which comes back to the demeaning side, the mediocrity producing side of teaching, to reduce this intensely personal, if very thoughtful act, to a checklist or to a prescribed sequence is simply to smother it.
Let me bring up an impossible-to-answer question and see what you have to say about it. You know, when you see how so many of the schools are just falling to pieces, you wonder, is it some kind of larger problem in the social fabric that's breaking down, or is it the system within the schools? And is it possible to really reform the schools without really reforming society? But if you wait till society is reformed, well, that's not going to do you any good for your children for today, you know? So do you think it's possible to really make an impact in the schools and in students' attitudes towards going to school and towards learning when a lot of the students going to school are going in you know, abject poverty with violence both in and out of the schools?
Well, sure, you can't reform schools without reforming society and vice versa, but that's a recipe for despair.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of us starts where he or she is at. I happen to be in a high school. You have to find your own niche and work at it. But it is very difficult these days. I mean, I started my teaching career in the 50s, and it's tougher to grow up in America today than it was in the 50s. And politicians have always lied. But I don't think it is a jaundice on my part to think that the contemporary politicians tolerate misspeaking a little more rapidly than did, for instance, Dwight Eisenhower. The readiness to have the slick 30-second spot, which sends out a message which deliberately distorts, the toleration of that, the glorious and almost humorous ironies of having state lotteries to support education, state lotteries depending either on the mathematical incompetence of the people or on addicts. I mean, anybody who thinks hard about why lotteries work gets pretty depressed. And it's a pretty forlorn society that takes something which is which depends on ignorance or addiction as a way of supporting the schools. One can go on and on. The neglect of our young people, the fact that a fifth of American children are growing up in poverty, the abuse of children in the media as well as in the street, these things are just horrendous. Now, we teachers can't just wring our hands and curse. We have to say what we believe about the corrupting influence that the society in its mindlessness is inflicting on kids. But then we have to just pull up our socks and move ahead and do what we can within the framework of the school, working with those families.
Educator Ted Sizer. He chairs the Coalition of Essential Schools at Brown University. His new book is Horace's School, Redesigning the American High School. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.